I'm Nigel Swart for BizNews.com, and joining me today is Professor Sean Davison, New Zealand-born South African scientist and founder and director of the pro-euthanasia group Dignity South Africa. Sean, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to talk to you today.
Our discussion today and the subject matter that we'll be exploring is necessarily personal in nature. So before we dive right in a few short sentences, who is Sean Davison?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a human being and a family man. I may be perceived as a campaigner for a law change, but first and foremost, I'm a human being, a family man who loves his children and enjoys his work. The Right to Die campaign is quite a different side. I'm split into two people.
In 2010, you were arrested in New Zealand and charged with the attempted murder of your terminally ill mother, Dr. Patricia Ferguson. Talk to me about the months leading up to her passing and the details of your participation in her death.
Sure. My mother was elderly. She was 85 years old and living in New Zealand, and I was living in South Africa. So when the time came when she was getting near the end of life, I went to New Zealand to be with her. And that was kind of a way of celebrating her life. She'd lived a full life. There's no idea that she was going to have a dreadful death at all. But while I was there, she decided to go on a hunger strike to end her life because she was a medical doctor and she knew, as a doctor, the dreadful death that awaited her from the cancer. So she made a medical decision: I'm going to have control of my death by going on a hunger strike. And if you stop eating, there's only one thing that can happen: you die. Okay, it seemed a bit of a shock to me. I wasn't expecting it, but I trusted her medical judgment, and she was my mother. You do what your mother says. And she wrote a living will saying what she was going to do, and she asked us, her children, to respect it, which we did. My other siblings came and said goodbye to her. We all lived in different corners of the world, and I decided to stay with her until the end as her sole caregiver. And what happened next was quite a shock. The hunger strike went on and on and on. All she was doing was drinking a glass of water each day for comfort. And the days went by and the weeks went by. And after 5 weeks of not eating, her flesh was breaking down on her body. She could not move her arms or her legs, but her brain, her heart, her kidneys, her lungs, all functioning perfectly. In other words, her body was breaking down to feed her vital organs. But at that point, she could not end her own life. And she was not the kind of woman or person to ask for help to die. But she couldn't end it. She was immobile, almost like a quadriplegic at that point. And at that point, only at that point, she begged for help to die. She realized that this condition could keep on going for many days or even weeks, rotting in her own bed.
Yeah.
So initially, I was kind of shocked and thought, well, I can't do this. I'm so focused on keeping you alive, ironically. But really, at the end of the day, I realized it was not my choice. It was my mother's choice. She wanted to die while she had a little bit of dignity that was only going to get worse. And yeah, so I did agree to help her to die.
Now, how did you do it?
She had been hoarding morphine tablets herself. They had been prescribed by her own GP. She didn't take them. She always said, I'm keeping these just in case. And I didn't think just in case was ever going to happen. I thought she's going to die from a hunger strike. And eventually, when the time came, she said, I've got these tablets. I've got quite a lot. Crush them up, mix them with water, please, because I can't do it myself. I can't move my arms. And in effect, I became her arms, doing what she could not do herself to help her to die.
You subsequently wrote a book, Before We Say Goodbye, in which you detailed what you just told me. Am I correct in saying that had it not been for this book, you may never have been charged with your involvement in her death?
Well, let's go back. Initially, I wrote a diary. I kept a diary at the time of my mother's dying. And I showed it to my sister in New Zealand just to show her what I'd been through. And my sister, Joanna, she had worked as a social worker. And she said, you've got to publish this. She's seen many cases like this, not just people having a dreadful death, but loved ones helping another loved one to die. She said, these people are alone and suffering in anguish, thinking they're alone and they're the only person who's done it. Publish your story. The story I published, the book, the first book, Before We Say Goodbye, did not include the details of how my mother died, how I helped her, the first edition. However, my sister, I had two sisters, the other one was opposed to this book and what happened, and she reported me to the police. So it wasn't the book that led to the arrest, it was the draft of the book sent to the police in Auckland, New Zealand. So a complicated story, but these things happen.
How is your relationship with your sister today, the one who took the book to the police?
Well, we had no communication since then, 2010. So, yeah, non-existent relationship. Yeah. She was a medical doctor too, and a gerontologist. She specialised in medicine for the elderly. She had her reasons for doing it, yeah. And, yeah, I don't know whether she regrets doing it after what happened, all the court cases. And in fact, that's what led to where I am today in New Zealand. Yeah. If it wasn't for my arrest in New Zealand, I wouldn't have founded the organisation in South Africa and wouldn't have led to other convictions in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a defining point in my life. Wow.
Assisted suicide between doctor and patient is already, I mean, the gravity of something like that cannot be overestimated, but between a mother and son, that's on a whole different level. Were neither of your sisters privy to your mom's request?
No. My mother had stated earlier, in fact, many years before she died, and 10 years before, she always said, I don't want to suffer at the end of life. Now, that kind of meant nothing to me. I was young, enjoying life. You don't think about it. And only after she died, I realized, yeah, she did state that a lot, and I didn't listen to it. Because I now state it to my kids. I say, I don't want to suffer at the end, highlighting the need for this conversation. Let people know, so when the time comes, you're not going against their wishes. My mother made it very clear she didn't want to suffer. And sure enough, yeah, she did suffer at her own hands by going on a hunger strike. But in the end, I helped her, clearly from her instruction, her request. But it highlights the need to talk about it. We need to talk about it. We've talked about so many things as a society we didn't used to talk about, HIV, AIDS, homosexuality. Now my kids are talking about it in primary school and classroom lessons.
Yes.
But we're very reluctant to talk about death and dying, even though we're all going to die. We're all going to lose our parents and our grandparents. If we have the discussion, it makes us ready for it. And it's not such a shock. And it can be, in a way, a celebration, as I said, celebrating the life of the person.
Yeah. I mean, I think also a discussion of the choice that you were confronted with, which was watching her fade away day after day after day, and helping her get to the same end less painfully. It's very complex, but at the same time, it's very simple, and we'll get into that later. You received a 5-month house arrest sentence. After which you returned to South Africa. And between 2013 and 2015, you assisted in the suicides of 3 terminally ill men, Justin Varian, Richard Holland, and Dr. Ulrich Berger.
Not terminally ill, but suffering unbearably, yeah. One was a quadriplegic, one had motor neuron disease, and one had locked-in syndrome, yeah. Terminally ill means you've got a short prognosis of how long you're going to live. These men, not terminally ill, but suffering unbearably with no hope of recovery.
Which is almost worse.
Yeah, I'd say much, much worse, yeah. But both groups unable to end their own life. A terminally ill person like my mother, very, very weak, could have ended her life, but it could have been by a horrible means. The 3 men I helped to die, totally incapable of ending their own life. And that's a very important point.
You're not a medical doctor, though. How did the pleas of these 3 men come to your attention, and what were the circumstances that enabled you to bring about their deaths?
They approached me because of the organization Dignity South Africa. Not the only ones. Even today, I get a request each week, at least a week on average, every week on average. First of all, it's Dr. Anna Berger, a medical doctor. He broke the spine in a motor car accident. He had attempted to end his own life within the year of his accident, after the accident. In the following 6 years, he repeatedly asked his doctor friends for help. No one offered him help. And his family members, nobody would help him. He approached me initially to support the organization Dignity SA. But once our friendship grew, we got on very well. I started visiting him as a friend quite often. Eventually, the conversation came round to his absolute desire to die. He didn't consider his life worth living. And that was his decision, not mine. The sad thing about it, he was, when I agreed to help him, initially I agreed to help him by going to Dignitas with him in Switzerland. Eventually he decided he wanted to die at home. Why travel to Europe to die? When he was a South African, he wanted to die in his own country. When I agreed to help him, he was very concerned something might happen to me. If I had a road accident and died, he'd be stuck as a quadriplegic in his wheelchair until somebody else might agree to help him. And in a way, I feel maybe he rushed his death while I was alive in case something happened to me. And that I find very, very sad. But yeah, he was desperate to die. Yeah.
I find it interesting that your account of that situation focuses on, he's South African, he wanted to die in his own home. You know, why not do it here with your help instead of going to Switzerland? But the fundamental difference is the consequences that you've had to face as a result. Mm. You went ahead with it anyway, and you helped two other men as well. Before we move on, what were the respective circumstances of the other two gentlemen?
The gentleman with locked-in syndrome, he was Richard Holland, a South African triathlete. He'd been knocked off his bicycle, broke his neck. His immobility was much worse than Dr. Berger's. The only part of his body he could move was one thumb and one eyelid. And from that, he was able to communicate using an alphabet board. His mother would hold the board, pointing to letters, and he would spell out words, clearly showing he hadn't lost his mental functions. He's quite rational in his decisions. But he too, after 2 years of trying every possible option to try and repair a broken back, he can't do that, he decided his life wasn't going to be worth living. And life was not about living, it was about enjoying it. It wasn't just about being alive.
Yeah.
And he wanted to die. The other was Justin Varian. He had motor neuron disease, a disease that can strike you out of the blue. I think a lot of South Africans are familiar with Joost van der Westhuizen, the Springbok rugby player. His dying days portrayed in the media, we were all shocked at how quickly he declined and died.
No, your body sort of turns against itself.
Yes, absolutely. And same for Justin Varian, just very quickly declined. He was beyond a point where he could end his own life too, when he reached out to me through Dignity South Africa. And as you point out, I didn't have a medical degree. I don't have one. And I shouldn't have been in that situation. But no doctor was willing to help.
Where did you find the means to bring about their deaths? How did you do it?
Yeah, the information is available on the internet. And because I was involved in the Right to Die movement, I knew what options were available. The medication was not available in South Africa and had to be obtained from Mexico. All these steps are risky. You don't know quite what you're getting. The whole process is becoming risky and you're breaking the law. It just shouldn't be like that.
What medication was it?
It's called Nebutol, or Nebutol is a common name for the medication. Richard Holland had that, and Dr. Berger had something else prescribed for animals. We couldn't get hold of Nebutol. He prescribed it for himself. It's also used for humans I'm not quite sure. There is a medical condition where you need it, but you need a high amount of it to end your life. And he did that research. Oh, it's called phenobarbital. He obtained it, a lot of it, 80 tablets had to be crushed up and drunk. He knew what to take. He went to the pharmacy with his own prescription as a doctor, obtained it, and asked me to be his hands to crush it up and mix it with water. The irony of this whole situation is that ending your life is not illegal. You can commit suicide. No one's going to arrest you if you're dead. These three gentlemen were committing suicide with help, and that is illegal. And this is where there's a big, big flaw in the law. Why should they be discriminated against because they can't do it for themselves? Very unfair.
Essentially, if you do look at it that way, it really is an almost unforgivable discrimination against people with disabilities.
If you want to extend that logic, it's actually harder for a woman to commit suicide, has been shown. So in that respect, the law discriminates against women. And you can see this when you look at the data from Dignitas in Switzerland or other countries where the law has changed. More women have a legal assisted death. And the initial interpretation, wow, this is taking advantage of women, this is shocking. But in fact, if you look at the data for men committing suicide, it's much higher than women. So in other words, it's actually easier for a man to shoot himself or hang himself by violent means than a woman. And if you study the brain anatomy, you'd actually find a logical reason for why that is. But I won't go into neuroscience at the moment.
I can't help myself, though. I have to ask, is it a emotional distinction between male and female? It can't purely be a physical capability of being able to hang yourself or shoot yourself, because otherwise, you know, there wouldn't be cases in women that do that.
Yeah, that's quite related to brain anatomy. You know how the male and female, or all humans, have two hemispheres to the brain? They're linked by the corpus callosum between the two. And the entire networking of a woman's brain is much greater, much more networking. A woman uses all her brain at the same time. Yeah, I'm sure you can understand that.
Very tiring.
Men tend to compartmentalize their thoughts. And when you're ending your life, the rationale is that you need to compartmentalize that thought. You're shutting off everything. You're saying, I don't want any kind of stimulation. I'm ending my life. Whereas a woman, as she's mentioned, are more emotional. There's more neuro signals all over the brain. It's much harder to do. So she's being selected against in her ability to end her own life.
This distinction, I mean, I may be stretching it further than my circle of competence, but women are more likely to commit suicide by overdose, while men will hang themselves or shoot themselves. And also, just slightly related, men that commit murder, it's more likely by violent means, where women are inclined to use means like poison. So it fits. When you came to South Africa and you assisted in the deaths of these men, you did so fully accepting that you may face the same fate as you did in New Zealand. Were you public about having been involved in their deaths? Did their families know? How did you go about it? Because surely you must have felt, you know, an impending reckoning of sorts, regardless of, you know, the absence of good reasons for it.
It was between me and the person I was helping to die. The first person was Dr. Ulrich Berger, who was going to go to Switzerland, Dignitas, and chose to die at home. The only person who knew about it was his partner, female partner, and his mother. His mother was highly supportive. She very grateful to me. She said, you know, the hardest thing in life is having a child begging to die. She would have gone to Switzerland when he was going to go, but she was happy for me to go, and she was very happy for me to help him to die. His partner at that time was opposed to it. She's agreeing to him going to Switzerland, but didn't want to be involved in his death. And she was the one who reported me to the police here straight after his death.
And that was even though she was aware of the process up until the time it happened.
I'd been to visit Dr. Ulrich Berger many times. She was there, often speaking openly about his plan to die. It was never a secret. When he did die, he kept it secret. He didn't want her stopping him.
But how could she have believed that, you know, it happened other than with your assistance if he was physically incapable of doing it himself?
After it happened, she knew. Oh, yes. He died in a hotel in Cape Town. He booked it. Obviously, she had to be informed he had died and how it happened. He and I had no idea that she would do this, because he was dying. He didn't want me to get into trouble. He'd been speaking about it ever since she met him. She met him after he became a quadriplegic.
Oh, okay.
And indeed, when he was going to Switzerland, he was interviewed by the U magazine. It was public knowledge that he'd made it, he told the whole world. So it was not a secret, and it should not have been a surprise. And yeah, it was a big surprise to me when she reported me to the police. Yeah.
June 2019, you were charged with the murder of these three men. And you reached a plea bargain in which you pleaded guilty to three counts of murder. After your house arrest sentence was lifted, however, you repeatedly stated that you did not commit a crime and that you are not a murderer. Was your admission of guilt in the plea bargain purely strategic to get a lighter sentence?
Partly, but I pleaded guilty at the plea bargain because what I did fitted into the definition of the law. Yeah, according to the law, assisting a suicide was defined as murder. So I was admitting to that. Yes, and when I came out of the plea bargain, I called it as it was. It wasn't murder. Some people think I'm being hypocritical, admitting to murder and then denying it. It's been said a few times,
You know, more significantly, it highlights a fundamental conflict between common law and constitutional law, that the definition of murder can encompass assisted suicide. It's just a serious revision is required. Throughout your trials, your biggest advocate was the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who's arguably the most powerful ally you could have had in your corner. What's the story there? What was the nature of your relationship with him?
Yeah, certainly without Archbishop Tutu, I'm quite certain I would have gone to jail for these murders. It began in 2010 in New Zealand. At that point, he was the chancellor of my university, University of the Western Cape. And he just instinctively came to my rescue, requesting the court in New Zealand to allow me to return to South Africa until my trial, which was unheard of in New Zealand, getting a murderer accused out of the country.
Had you personally met him?
No, only in passing, as many professors had met the Chancellor. I don't think I'd stood out in his mind. Of course, when I came back on bail, I introduced myself and thanked him, and we bonded very nicely. Then I honoured his request to the court and went back to New Zealand to stand trial. I was convicted of assisted suicide in a plea bargain in the court trial, and he wrote to the court requesting leniency in my sentencing, saying this was really not a horrendous crime. He helped his mother. And I got a very lenient sentence. And the judge, French, she said, she listened to Desmond Tutu and that made a big difference. The only previous case in New Zealand was a woman helping her mother to die, and she got a 2-year jail sentence, let out after 1 year on parole. But she went to jail time. And I was facing the same risk. I didn't even know about her when I was involved with my mother's death. And then in South Africa, when I was arrested the next day, Desmond Tutu came out to the media defending me without even knowing the details, because we'd established a friendship over the previous eight years or so. He knew me and he knew I had not committed murder. Without knowing any more, he came out and said he supports me. I remember the headline, Tutu supports Davison, and that made a big difference. A lot of people were wondering, helping your mother's one thing. Now you've been charged with murder and the court said there'll be other charges coming. People were probably wondering what's going on. But when Desmond Tutu came out the next day, made me feel a lot happier.
Had he formally in any way been an advocate for voluntary euthanasia? Or was it just jumping to the defense of someone he genuinely believed to have acted in good faith?
I met him over the years from the time I was released from New Zealand, my sentence, and he told me he'd never thought about the issue until he heard about my mother's death and started thinking about it. And eventually he became the leading advocate for the right to die. He penned a letter for the Guardian newspaper or the Observer paper in England, detailing his support for end-of-life legislation. And he detailed it in the African ancestral religion context. A few years later in the Washington Post, he wrote a letter saying he would like an assisted death if necessary. What better recommendation for a law change can you get than that? Yeah. And he was a Christian and a supporter of African ancestral religions. He showed it wasn't a religious issue. It's a human rights issue. And yeah, the world listened.
Even though, you know, bringing about the deaths of these men, and especially your own mother, was out of compassion, taking a human life must have a significant toll on the human psyche. Can you walk me through your emotional and mental processes as you brought about the deaths of these individuals?
Yeah, it is difficult, very difficult to end a life. It does take intellectual rationalizing to realize that death is inevitable and you don't want them to suffer. As I said, in my mother's case, my instinct was to keep her alive, even though she was 85 and terminally ill. But then I rationalized that, okay, I'm not keeping her alive, I'm making each day as comfortable as possible. But then the point comes, ending a life. But the balance of that thinking is that you're ending their suffering. And it's a bit cliched, we do it to our dogs and our cats, and you feel relief in the end to end their suffering. Mm. And I also felt relief at ending the suffering of those three men. They were genuinely suffering. Yeah. The things they said they were going to try and do to end their life if I wasn't there would have been a dreadful, dreadful death. What can a quadriplegic do? They can try and choke themselves to death on food, suffocate, push their wheelchair in front of a train or off a cliff, drown themselves, all violent means. Mm. And yeah, I was providing them a dignified, peaceful death.
Mm. You know, it just highlights a further sort of absurdity in the logic around refusal to decriminalize voluntary euthanasia, because it can be argued that neglecting to help them is really assisting in their own facilitation of a way less dignified death.
The defining line in the Hippocratic Oath is to do no harm. And that was written in 500 BC. Now, medical technology has changed quite a lot in the last, 2,000 odd years. And keeping people alive long beyond the time they want to be alive is doing harm. So we're actually contrary to the original meaning of the Hippocratic Oath.
The fact that in both New Zealand and South Africa, but let's focus on South Africa, you were handed such a light sentence for a, you know, conviction of murder, it indicates a significant shift around the public perception of euthanasia. In my fourth year of law, my legal thesis was an argument in favor of euthanasia. Now, this is 10 years ago, but even then, the constitutional support in favor thereof was solid. I mean, the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights, particularly the right to human dignity, and I'd argue the right to life, are objectively in line with voluntary euthanasia. So in your campaigning for a law change to allow for voluntary euthanasia, on what grounds is this petition being refused?
Yeah, I think it's very important this case gets to the Constitutional Court. As you say, we have a very liberal constitution. Dignity and life is a theme of it. And when you're dying, you're still alive, and dignity and death should be included. I'm certain when this gets to the Constitutional Court, it will support an assisted death. Mm. Parliament is opposing it. We're never going to get through Parliament with a bill. But if the Constitutional Court recommends it, the Constitutional Court and the Parliament are on different pages, Parliament will be forced to change the law. We've got a case going to court at the moment. We previously had a case of Robin Strentham Ford. Mm-hmm. He was granted an assisted death in the High Court. It was challenged by the government in the Supreme Court of Appeal and overturned. We, Dignity SA, made a big mistake in not going to the Constitutional Court then. We received bad legal advice not to. We should have.
On what basis were you advised not to go to the Constitutional Court?
We just didn't have good lawyers, bad lawyers. They've been sacked now. We've got new lawyers. And we're going to the court with Adita Hark. He's got motor neuron disease. Mm-hmm. And if it's turned down in the High Court, we will challenge it in the Supreme Court of Appeal. If he's turned down an assisted death in the Supreme Court of Appeal, we'll go to the Constitutional Court. And there we're very confident of succeeding based on the constitution. Yeah. And this could happen within a year. Yeah.
What's changed? It might be the very obvious answer that you don't want to be subjected to months of house arrest again, but is there an additional reason that you're pursuing it via this avenue now and not the way you did in the past?
If I took my case to the Constitutional Court, helping Dr. Anna Berger to die, there was a risk attached. In his case, we did talk about that, it was going to take too long. To get a case to the High Court and eventually to the Constitutional Court can take many years. Even though he's not terminally ill, he did not want to live and risk not succeeding in the Constitutional Court. But the same for all three gentlemen, yeah. But you're right, they could have theoretically gone to the court, yeah.
One of the primary points of contention in the argument pro versus anti-euthanasia, that it's a slippery slope. In Belgium, for example, the eligibility criteria have expanded to now include non-terminally ill people that suffer from severe depression or personality disorders. With these countries, Belgium as an example, the goalposts seem to be shifting in terms of the hard and fast criteria. Where do you stand in terms of the eligibility criteria for voluntary euthanasia? And once established, how would you propose these goalposts not to be transgressed?
That's a good question. The shifting of goalposts could be for a very good reason. We have to ask why they've been shifted. Looking at Belgium, which is the most liberal law in the world, they do include psychological suffering quite a lot, but it's all defined as unbearable suffering. There's a controversial case some years ago where two brothers, twin brothers, they were deaf and they communicated by sign language. And they had a wonderful relationship. They worked together, they lived together. They're in their 30s, I think maybe 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Then one of them or both of them were diagnosed as going blind, which meant they could not communicate at all, unable to see each other or hear each other. And they were granted an assisted death based on unbearable suffering. Yeah. And some people would say that's going too far. But now, before you judge, you have to put yourself in their position. It's very quick to say, ooh, it sounds far too liberal. But if I were them, my sole friend in life, my brother, who I communicated with by this language, now we can no longer communicate. I might want to die, but it'd be my choice. I decide my unbearable suffering, not a doctor or a psychologist.
Yeah.
And it was granted, and they did have an assisted death. They could have committed suicide by whatever means they liked, but there are risks when you attempt to end your own life. Having a doctor-assisted death is peaceful and guaranteed. And there are many similar cases like that I could quote in Belgium.
The thing about that argument, however, is that it can simultaneously be used to argue the opposite, being, yes, don't judge another's pain, but the acceptance that emotional pain and suffering is subjective almost necessarily complicates established criteria. How and who gets to decide whether someone's pain is sufficiently intolerable for their death to be granted?
Yeah, it's like a Hippocratic oath. We have to re-examine established criteria. And I think it's now accepted by experts in the field that psychological suffering is no different than physical suffering. And studies of the brain have been conclusively showing this. There's a somatosensory cortex in the brain that can tell where the pain is coming from. You can actually desensitize it, blindfold a person, and cut their hand, and they won't know whether they received physical pain or psychological pain. They know they're in pain. They're almost in tears. It's quite fascinating research, but if you can, basically you're anesthetizing the part of the brain that detects other body parts. So you won't know your hand has been touched. Anyway, that's quite interesting research. But psychological suffering can really only be determined by an individual, their own choice, their own feeling. the law would prevent them having an assisted death immediately. We don't want a Romeo and Juliet situation where suffering, heartbreak, away they go, end their life. Although, of course, they could do that on their own. We can't stop that. The bottom line is their interpretation of unbearable suffering. Keep in mind, by applying to have an assisted death, there's a process to go through.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, they meet psychologists who could encourage them to live, and maybe for the first time ever, they're coming across a psychologist. Now, if they didn't apply for an assisted death, they could go and end their life without having any intervention to help them. In many ways, a law change is actually saving lives in that context.
Mm.
If you look at Oregon, the first state in the United States to change the law, there, 40%, 40, of the people who apply for an assisted death and have it approved don't follow through with the assisted death, but have a natural death.
People that are terminally ill that apply for assisted suicide, they decide against it.
They don't take up the option. 40%, a very high number, implying that they're getting enough enjoyment out of life. They don't really want to end it yet. They'd rather have a few more days, weeks, or months. But they want to know they've got that option to end it when they want to. My mother might not have gone on a hunger strike if she knew any time I want to, a doctor can give me an assisted death. Why should I take the risk of this hunger strike? This is where it applies. It actually saves lives, ends people ending their life, suicides.
And just to close off with, did you start campaigning in favor of voluntary euthanasia prior to your criminal convictions, or did it sort of happen as a result of one another?
It was as a result of my awareness of the suffering at dying before death. When my mother died, I hadn't thought about euthanasia. It just hadn't crossed my mind. And highlighting the need to talk about it now to make people aware of the issue. And after she died and I got bombarded with requests and information requests from people because of my name was in the media, I realized my story wasn't the only one. It was out there everywhere. And I saw the need to change the law. But I hadn't thought about it at all. Yeah. We're all going to die. And we all might face the question of ending our own life. Probably the most important philosophical question we'll ever face.
Yeah.
All the other questions, philosophical questions, are very important, very interesting, but we don't have to answer them. We may have to answer the question whether to end our own life. It's good to think about it while we're healthy.
Would you say that's the fundamental reason that this is such a personal cause for you? Because you've risked your livelihood, your lifetime with your family, reputation, I mean, the list is endless, in servitude of this belief.
Yeah.
Is it because of your very deep understanding of this kind of complexity as a result of your initial experience with your mother?
I've come to realize it's so fundamentally right to have the option of an assisted death, to choose your own time of dying. I don't want to be a campaigner. I'm a family man. I want to be home, playing with my children, having a normal, happy life.
Yeah.
But while being that man, I don't want to be ashamed of what I didn't do. When I know what's right and to be ignoring it, I would be ashamed of what I'm not doing. So I keep going because I know what I'm doing is right. I have just no doubt about that. What I find very interesting is that, okay, terminally ill people can understand, even when we get to quadriplegics, physical disabilities, but when we move into psychological issues and depression, a complete block. We can't go over that line. But my feeling is if we're going to change the law, let's embrace the whole issue and do it in one go rather than step by step by step. Maybe that's not a good idea. I don't know. Maybe the public can't accept that.
In light of what you just told me about so many people actually needing to go there to give life another chance, you know, for this renewed perspective, having to go through this process.
Saves lives, yeah.
There's a lot of virtue in it.
Because it takes time to have an assisted death. You have to plan it and go through these various hoops rather than an irrational immediate death over.
Have you found that the public in general and people that will generally entertain conversation around euthanasia are less likely to take you seriously because of your criminal convictions, or more likely to listen to you because you have a very clear, sincere devotion to the cause.
Yeah, I've found everywhere overwhelming support, even in religious groups. Mm. I think most religious groups don't see this as a religious issue. It's very much a human rights issue. It's about human suffering. And my feeling is that the mood of the country is very much for a law change. I just wish our politicians would embrace it. Other countries have changed the law quite dramatically in the last 5 years. New Zealand, Australia, completely, Spain, Austria, four countries while I was on house arrest changed the law.
It's actually quite odd that, you know, given how liberal our constitution is, we haven't made that jump.
But as you say, let's get it to the Constitutional Court and they will probably look at the world mood and see what countries are changing the law. And yeah, I'm optimistic, very optimistic.